Greetings, this is Spencer Dobson.
And this is Corey Heidelberger on this week's Dakota Free Press Podcast. The borehole is kaput. Brand new Congress fields a South Dakota candidate. We put statistics, statistics, into our petitions. Raw milk, will it kill ya? And our interview with Aberdeen City Council candidate Mike Olson.
So how are you, Corey?
I'm doing great. Spencer, how are you? I hear you had a great weekend in the Black Hills.
I had a fantastic weekend. If you are a regular listener, you know a couple of weeks ago, maybe even a couple of months ago, we did a story about a New York Times article where the guy went to Mount Rushmore and was drinking a beer and was so offended that the label said Sick and Twisted. And that is a brewery in Hill City, and they also are the Naked Winery. And I did a show there last Saturday on the 20th. Fantastic. The nicest people. I don't drink, but my wife said she had a ginger beer that was a beer with, like, a ginger beer except with alcohol in it. Fantastic. She had a really good glass of wine. She bought a couple of bottles of wine for friends. If you get a chance, go there. And also, the guy really talked a lot of smack about the food in the area. And
you found good food in the hills, right?
Oh, my God. I'm going to give you a quick plug. I wrote everything down. This will only take 2 seconds.
Up are some unpaid plugs.
But if you're traveling to Rapid City, Harriet and Oak Coffee Shop, I had the best mocha I've ever had in my life. And I'm really terrible about coffee. I'm pretty persnickety. Tally Silver Spoon. Unbelievable breakfast. Get the duck, duck, goose. It's duck confit and poached eggs and the pate. The foie gras. It's foie gras.
Oui,
and,
it's French.
Everything.
And that's Tally's downtown, right across from Alex Johnson in Rapid. Right.
That's right. Tally's
popular Silver spot.
Yep. And the Naked Winery. Again, great food, great people, great show. And my wife turns out loves rocks. And if you like rocks, holy crap, you're gonna find some rocks.
Black Hills is kind of built on rocks.
Yes, it really is. And so we just had a wonderful time. And that guy in New York is wrong.
Well, and I'll add, yeah, guy in New York, come back, bring the family. There's more to do in the hills than you saw.
Yeah.
And if you like rocks, a couple of years ago, I remember we took our daughter to the Geology Museum in Hill City. Rocks, dinosaur bones, skeletons, the works. You know, it's a smallish building. You know, it's not some massive New York style museum. But the amount of stuff in there and the nice diversion it makes to a day in the hills, you know, you spend some time at the coffee shop, then you spend some time hiking and fishing, and then you come into town and you see some science like that, along with cool dinosaur toys. It's a great stop.
There's great public art all over the place. Again, we can go on and on and on and on. But shut up, New York. You're wrong about the Black Hills. Okay, if you got a couple of bucks and you want to throw it in the tip jar, these two things are not related. We didn't just plug a bunch of stuff so that you could put money in the tip jar, wink. I'm being facetious, but if you like the podcast, there's a tip jar in the comment section or on the website. If you want to throw us a couple of bucks, it keeps the doors open. Who's our guest today, Corey?
Our guest today, we're going to talk to Mike Olson, who's a city council candidate. We've got lots of candidates here in town, school board and city council. Mike came over to speak with us, and we'll have that coming up later in the show.
Let's get to it. Quick topics. Number one. The borehole isn't happening.
Now, this is not boring, I promise.
This isn't boring. This is. I went into the borehole like I like the name borehole. That's kind of science fiction-y and a little scary. So here's the thing. We don't really know what to do with all of our nuclear waste. They want to put it in Nevada at the Yucca Mountain. And Nevada's like, you're not putting your nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain. So that legislation keeps happening and then being rescinded and happening and being rescinded. All of our nuclear waste is being stored in temporary facilities that are already overdue.
Yes, they're in canisters, in barrels, in vats, waiting to be transported somewhere else. So keep in mind, this is nuclear waste sitting around waiting for someone to pick it up in a truck and take it somewhere once we figure out what to do with it.
So what they want to do is go like 3 miles deep, correct? And by the way, straightest, deepest, not the deepest hole, but the deepest straight hole.
Right.
If
you've dug post holes in your yard with your shovel or even the cool, you know, grabber and auger thing, trying to make holes in your yard, a couple feet down for your concrete, imagine trying to drill a hole like that 3 miles deep, 17 inches wide, but perfectly straight, not just through dirt, not just through clay, but through bedrock. You can't have any bumps or hitches or turns in this hole, because the plan is to dig this hole 3 miles straight down and then drop metal canisters filled with nuclear waste down to the bottom. If your hole has any bumps or imperfections or bends, your can's going to get stuck a mile down, 1.5 miles down, and then you got to send some skinny guy down to get it out of there. That's not going to happen. So that's the really cool engineering trick here.
Right.
We want to dig perfectly straight 3 mile holes down into the earth just to see if we can do it. We don't know if we can drill a hole that well. And if we can, then to talk about, okay, could we drill holes like this somewhere else so we could dispose of our nuclear waste permanently in these boreholes?
And they are not talking about putting nuclear waste in this particular borehole. This is for scientific research. This is a dry run.
Right. We're not even at the do it stage. We're at the can we even dig a hole stage.
And there's,
which would then be followed by, if we can dig a hole that deep, can we get a can down to the bottom of it? And then can we cover it up with enough stuff and make it solid and not have it leak or anything?
Right. And I will say, Edward Biggs, chairman of the Hankin County Commission, said, your gut instinct tells you that that's where it would lead to in 10 to 15 years, meaning he wasn't completely convinced that they wouldn't use it for nuclear storage later. That was in the Aberdeen American News today.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Nothing anybody is saying says that that's what they're going to do. I understand his concern, but we really need to figure something out. And this is a big step in helping us figure something out. But what happened is the Trump administration said, we're not going to do that. We have to put more money into the sinkhole in front of Mar-a-Lago. So we're channeling all our funds there, apparently. Which
I know that sinkhole is only 4 foot deep, but I wouldn't mind putting nuclear waste there. That sounds like
that
a solution.
That seems like a great idea. So they did it for budgetary concerns. That's why they did it, because they're screwing with the budget in ways that are not probably going to be beneficial for anybody.
Right. And you mentioned Yucca Mountain. Actually, the Trump administration has said, we just want to put the nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain.
Right.
Which might be just as much to poke a finger in the eye of former Democratic leader Harry Reid. Because Harry Reid didn't want it in Nevada and kept it from happening.
Right. And there's still no guarantee that it's going to happen at Yucca Mountain.
Right. And really, again, we don't know if the borehole concept would work.
Right.
But if you think about it, we have these options for nuclear waste. One, we can leave it where it is.
Right, which isn't going to work.
At defense facilities, at nuclear power plants, waiting for some permanent solution. Because all the engineers agree, we can't just leave it there.
But even where it's at is deteriorating. It's going to be a catastrophe if we don't do something.
It's deteriorating and it's accessible. So it's environmentally unsafe and it's security-wise unsafe. Option two is put it in Yucca Mountain, which is better than having it out in the open.
Right.
But that's still more accessible.
And that guaranteed to happen. There's no guarantee that's going to happen.
Right. Option three is digging boreholes.
Yeah.
Now, they won't dispose of all the waste. There are different kinds of nuclear waste or whatever.
Sure.
But at least to put some of the waste down there. From a theoretical perspective, I'd say, you know what? Putting that waste as far away from us as possible is the way to reduce the possibility it's going to affect anybody.
Right.
3 miles deep in the ground is about the furthest away that we can talk about moving that waste. It seems like the borehole, engineering-wise and scientifically, would be a reasonable thing to explore. But Trump administration says, we're not putting money into this project. It's canceled.
And they did it because of budgetary reasons. However, and this is how this story becomes a bunch of Corey's favorite things all wrapped into one. Because you've got your engineeringness.
Yes.
You've got your Trump doing something crappiness.
Not based on science.
And then you've got Kristi Noem misrepresenting it. So there, it all comes together into one fun thing.
Yes, because Kristi came out yesterday and said she praises the Trump administration for listening to the people and listening to concerns and ending the borehole project.
Right.
Trump didn't listen to anyone on this.
Trump isn't capable.
Trump barely listened to anybody in composing his entire budget, let alone getting into the granularity of the deep borehole field test that the Department of Energy wanted to do. This is just Trump throwing numbers around and wanting to throw more nuclear waste, which he wants to make more of by expanding our nuclear weapons program. He wants to make more waste and put it into what seems like a less secure, less desirable disposal situation.
Number two, BNC candidate Eric Brand New Terrell. Who doesn't like brand new things, Corey?
Brand new thing. Well, brand new Congress. That's what BNC stands for, right?
How exciting!
Well, if ask 80% of Americans, I think they'd say brand new Congress. You betcha.
But what is it?
Well, from what I understand, brand new Congress is actually it's a political group. Mm-hmm. It was formed by people who campaigned for Bernie Sanders last year.
Right.
And then decided, well, when Bernie didn't get the nomination, said, you know what, we need to make change at the congressional level.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as I understand their goals, they are trying to recruit, I think the number was 400. Mm-hmm. There are 538 members of Congress counting D.C. But they want to recruit 400 new candidates to run for Congress in 2018.
A couple of interesting things about these guys. Well, the Bernie Sanders people, we already know, are progressive Democrats who are not necessarily happy with the Democratic machine the way it functions right now.
Right.
But what they're also doing is looking for what are known as this rare unicorn, the progressive Republican.
Such a thing exists?
Well, apparently it does. Apparently there are a number of Republicans who are now looking at what their party has become, and they're not too happy about it either.
Good for them.
And so what the BNC has realized is that if they want to win in some of these southern states, I think Tennessee was one that they listed, Arkansas, correct?
Arkansas, yep.
If you're going to win, you're going to have an R. You're going to be a Republican, but you can be a BNC Republican. And they're kind of trying to take it over from within. And they've got some core ideas that they stick by. And then there's a little bit of wiggle room in there, too. You know, it's I Googled this, and literally the Dakota Free Press article about it was number 3.
Hey.
And then the article you were referencing was number 1. So there's not a lot of ink on this just yet, but it's a really interesting idea. And it's you know, there's some real, it sounds like there's some real people in here. And the article that you were referencing from was from the National Review, which is not just some fly by night BS, you know, piece of tabloid crap. It's a legitimate, journalistic, entity. And, the person that wrote the article was like, generally I would look at something like this as kind of a fly by night, but these people really have a track record. Yeah. So,
and the real person we're talking about here is this gentleman, this Eric Terrell from Rapid City.
Yes.
He apparently has filed papers this month with the Federal Election Commission saying he plans to run for Congress. He indicates he's a Republican, and I checked the voter rolls. There is an Eric Terrell from Rapid City who is a registered Republican.
Right.
But he's running apparently under the banner of Brand New Congress. Now, we know this because you can check his Facebook page, and he's got some links to their stuff, links to Bernie Sanders.
Right.
But also, and this was kind of the quirk that caught my attention, on his FEC candidacy paper, he gives his campaign address as an office in Knoxville, Tennessee.
As do
9 other candidates.
Who also share the same middle name of Brand New.
Well, here's the thing. There were three candidates, including Terrell, who wrote Brand New as their middle name.
Right.
Which kind of strikes me as silly marketing.
It's a little weird and culty to me, quite frankly.
Yeah, I understand the trick. You want people to know that you're Brand New. Yeah, that's cute, but to me, elections aren't cute. If you're doing something as serious as running for office, you should be writing your real name on these kind of documents. But point is, yes, Eric Terrell uses Brand New for his branding. A couple of these other candidates use it. And they're all from different states, but they're all listing Tennessee as their office address.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. We'll try to keep an eye on it for you. We'll see what happens. You know, I think everybody thinks things need to be shaken up in a positive way. And I think we need some grassroots people running for office. Hopefully this will turn out to be a positive organization. And if it doesn't, maybe something else will come in its place. But we'll keep an eye on it. Topic number 3. Man, this one, this is all Corey. I don't even know. I've read this article 3 times. And I am not positive what happened. Okay. HB 1035 has a thing about, okay, you get some statistics and then you sample the statistics and then there's numbers. What happened, Corey?
Spencer, this is the election nerd portion of our program today. Election nerds, listen up.
If you have coffee, drink it now.
Good.
We'll try to make this as short and palatable as humanly possible.
This actually snuck up on me. There was a bill, House Bill 1035 this year, that escaped my attention. The Secretary of State and the legislature put an amendment on it in March, like as the legislature is wrapping up, that I didn't know about, that changes how the Secretary of State certifies statewide petitions. Here's the deal. Right now, if you file a petition to run for statewide office, you know, governor or Congress, or if you file a ballot question petition, The Secretary of State doesn't actually review every signature you get.
Right.
She takes a random sample. She takes 5% of your signatures, checks those signatures to see if they're valid, figures out what percent are correct, and then multiplies your total submission by that percentage to say, yeah, it looks like your petition is good. So interesting, our Secretary of State doesn't look at every signature, she just takes a sample, basically to make it the process go faster.
Much the way if you're checking the amount of chlorine in your pool, you take a portion, you take a cup of it out, and you figure out the parts per million of chlorine in that cup, and then that extrapolates itself over across the whole pool.
Bingo, exactly. It's just, it's practicality.
I'm learned.
But an Aberdeen, a Northern State University statistician, Sarah Schmidt, looked at our 5% sample and said, that's not statistically rigorous. And so she, you know, broke out the stats book and found the formula. It's got square roots and stuff in it. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
But found the formula and gave it to the Secretary of State and said, if you have this many signatures, here's how many signatures you actually need to sample to be confident that you've done a good job, that you've got a sample that reflects the overall petition.
So they did that.
So they put that in law. Now, instead of taking a 5% sample, they take a sample based on a statistical formula that will provide a certain level of confidence. Interestingly, if you're doing a ballot question petition and you submit the minimum number of signatures, basically 14,000,
okay,
the Secretary of State will still sample basically the same number of signatures, because for that many signatures, about 14,000, 5% is the statistically rigorous number to take.
Okay.
But check this out. If you submit more signatures, let's say you do a ballot question and you submit 40,000 signatures.
Oh.
5% of 40,000, that's 2,000 signatures she has to read.
Right.
Under the new statistical rule of House Bill 1035, Chantel, the Secretary of State, Chantel Krebs, only has to sample 720 signatures.
Oh, that's quite a difference.
That's 2,000 signatures down to 720. That's a huge difference. But the stats say that's just as rigorous.
Do you think that will get this? So statistically, it will give her the same result?
According to statisticians, that's as reliable. 720 is as reliable as trying to do a 5%.
So she gets to go to lunch earlier that day?
That day, yes. Or gets to go on to other things.
And we're done.
Oh, but wait, there's more. I get one more. One more. The trade-off is candidate petitions, she'll actually have to count more signatures.
Sorry about your lunch.
It's okay. But as a candidate, if you're a Democrat and you want to run for governor, you only need, it's 700-some signatures. So let's say you submit 1,000 signatures.
Okay.
5% of that is 50 signatures.
Mm-hmm.
Still not a lot. The new statistical rule says, uh-oh, Chantel, instead of 50, you've got to sample 424 signatures from that candidate petition. So you win some, you lose some. It's all statistics. Chantel will get to go to lunch at some point, though.
So, and as a South Dakota resident, what will the impact be on your existence at any level?
For 99.999% of South Dakotans, not one
bit. Just say nothing. Okay, we're moving on. We're moving on.
I say that with statistical confidence.
And now we're going to go in depth. This one, I didn't think there was much of a story here, but turns out there's a lot of a story. It's a lot. It's a lot. A lot of people like homeopathic stuff. A lot of people like organic stuff. A lot of people like it fresh from the farm and blah, 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 blah. But, and raw milk is one of those things that has kind of grown. It's not it's not kombucha, but it's certainly...
It's raw milk. It's good
stuff.
It's
got its followers, man. People, is it?
Greatest raw... I've never had a lot of raw milk.
I don't think I've ever had raw milk.
But the most interesting milk I ever had was a jar of goat milk,
mm-hmm,
still warm from the udder.
Oh my gosh.
That an old granny gave me in Russia 25 years ago.
Wow.
I have a wonderful picture of my friend on that trip who's kind of taking a sip and going, pursing her lips and going, ooh, and I'm holding that jar. That was good stuff.
Well, and this is one of those things that's it's got that Gwyneth Paltrow-y sort of... Well, they did some research, and it turns out that statistically, according to one study, it might help with if your kid has allergies, for example. But even that science is kind of questionable. It's got that kind of new agey feel to it. People really like the idea of it. It's milk that hasn't been homogenized.
Yeah.
When you homogenize milk, it kills all the crap that's in it, all the little bugs and E. coli and
the
whatever.
The homogenizing, the pasteurizing, right.
Well, the CDC, the terrible, our terrible government who just wants your life to suck and takes your money. Anyway, between 2004 and 2014, it turns out 96% of dairy-related foodborne illness came from raw milk.
Yes, in outbreaks where you have these surges right. of all of a sudden a lot of people are reporting illnesses and that. Yeah, basically 19 out of 20 or 24 out of 25 cases.
You and your numbers.
Of illness where people, oh no, we got this raw milk from the farm and or this milk or this cheese. It came from raw milk, from unpasteurized dairy products.
Right. Now, I did a little bit of homework on here. There's a study done by a group of people called the Gabriella Group. There is a link in the there'll be a link in the comments if you want to. It's a bunch of doctors, basically, and they were in Europe, and their findings suggested the protective effect of raw milk consumption on asthma might be associated with the whey protein fraction of the milk.
So they're saying, in that case, raw milk is good for people.
But they're saying it suggests that raw milk may help you with your asthma. Mm-hmm. Now, part of the write-up of that, it was done, all of the people that they studied were kids that were living on farms. And the people that question the science say that there might be factors, that there might be other factors about living on a farm that created those results, not necessarily the raw milk. Mother Jones, but then I also found a Mother Jones article that about a family who started consuming raw milk to fight their kid's allergies, but it ended up giving the kid E. coli, which ended up shutting down the kid's kidneys. Now, the kid is now off of, I am blanking. Oh,
dialysis.
The kid is off of dialysis, mm-hmm. but they're not sure the kid's going to make it. Right. Like, it can literally kill you.
Right. We're not talking just, that 1 or 2 days of food poisoning where you're on the throne for a while feeling bad.
Right, right.
We're talking about ongoing, lifetime chronic problems.
Yeah. I looked up what E. coli can do to you. As a matter of fact, this is off the ever-reliable WebMD. There will be a link in the comments. But some E. coli is harmless, but it can cause bloody diarrhea. Some claws may also cause anemia and kidney failure, which can lead to death.
And you think my talk about election nerd statistics is gross? That's gross.
Well, I didn't say it was gross. I said it was boring. This is not boring. And gross is rarely boring.
I will agree. Severe diarrhea and kidney dialysis are not boring. They're pretty serious impacts.
Now, and as you put it, we are we're supposed to be kind of a libertarian state. It's a free market state. You can sell raw milk products in South Dakota.
Well, there's been kind of a fight about this. For a while, you actually couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Small producers, and here we kind of get into the business aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Like you say, the libertarian, the regulatory side of things. There are some small dairy producers left in South Dakota. They haven't all been crowded out by corporate milk. Who want to produce this product,
mm-hmm.
and there are consumers who want to buy it. They really had to fight, and Dakota Rural Action is an organization that helped them with this and some other groups to convince South Dakota to ease its regulations and allow local dairy farmers to sell their products to their neighbors
mm-hmm.
instead of it all having to go to the dairy, be processed, and then shipped out to your grocery store.
Right.
So yes, one can produce, one can sell, and one can consume raw milk in South Dakota, thanks to some recent changes.
However, as we keep talking about the risks of that, I don't know if they outweigh the benefits of it. I don't like to talk about things that I don't have a source for right off the top of my head. But someone was recently, I was listening to a podcast, and it might have been Neil deGrasse Tyson, and they were talking about, people have always been very concerned about the hormones that they put in milk, and they think that that's why children started going through puberty earlier, things like that. But the solubility of the hormones that they put in the milk, your digestive system destroys them, so they wouldn't be able to impact they wouldn't impact you that way, is what they've proven. So basically, there's a big scare about milk hormones that is basically a big scare.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an interesting issue in that there is a lot of science out there. And there are a lot of things that can happen because of stuff you put in your body.
Sure.
There are all sorts of chemical reactions that can happen. But I think the thrust of this CDC report is simply that you look at dairy products.
Right.
You look at what pasteurization does, which is get rid of E. coli and other pathogens, things that can make you sick. When you don't pasteurize, you have to recognize there's a greater chance that those pathogens are still going
to
be around.
When you don't pasteurize, you have to recognize.
My apologies to Jesse Jackson and to my dairy friends out there. But yeah, basically the new CDC report says among the people who are getting sick from dairy products, the vast majority of those sicknesses are arising from raw dairy products, yeah. raw milk products, the cheese they make from it, things where they're not taking advantage of the simple procedure right. of pasteurization. Right. And that's really, again, you know, it's to go back to our libertarian South Dakotan roots.
Right.
Even that doesn't necessarily say that the state should ban you from drinking raw milk. If right. you really want to take that warm jar of goat milk and down the hatch, well, far be it for me to get in the way of letting you put something in your body.
Right.
But you need to have a full view of the risks, not just to you, but like you said, that case where the, you know, a 10-year-old drank that milk and right. now has permanent kidney damage, that's something you have to think about when you're buying products for your family.
And even the raw milk people, like most of the pro raw milk stuff comes from a website called like Raw Milk or We Like Raw Milk or Raw Milk America. There wasn't a lot of science to support. There wasn't a lot of real science to support the benefits of raw milk. But even they say, make sure it's sanitary. Make sure you're, you know, make sure you understand the whole line of production. Make sure, you know, everything has been sanitized before you use it. So even they're not saying it's without risk.
Right. And now there is an interesting part too. If you're drinking milk and cheese or eating cheese, if you're a conscientious consumer, one can make the argument that buying raw milk from your local producer actually allows you more accountability in that regard. You buy a gallon of milk at the grocery store, you have little to no idea of who actually produced that milk or processed it.
Right,
you buy raw milk, you probably not even know the guy who made it, but you know the cow it came from. You maybe have been to that farm.
Yeah, but what benefit is it to go, you know, I've been drinking milk from the grocery store my whole life, and myself and no one I know has gotten sick from it. But now that I'm drinking raw milk, I know I got this E. coli that's killing me from Fred. So at least he's not getting a Christmas card.
Right. When you're actually sick from it, you're not going to feel that great about knowing.
Yeah, that doesn't really sick. That kind of cancels out any benefits you get from knowing that.
Sure.
So be careful out there. Again, you can still drink raw milk, but you should really do your homework on it, because it does not sound like. And again, there's no real proof that it's curing your kid's asthma. So there you go. Sorry, Glenn. So we're going to sit down and we're talking to Mike Olson.
Actually, his first name is Dennis, but he goes by his middle name, Mike. So right. when you see the signs around town, that's the guy who says, Dennis, quote Mark, Mike,
right.
unquote Mark Olson. He's on the city commission now, and he's running to fill out the term. He has an opponent in the Southeast District. So we've been calling candidates, and Mike Olson said, yeah, I'll talk to you guys.
Nice guy. Let's see what he had to say.
Well, I'm Dennis Mike Olson. I go by my middle name. I live here in Aberdeen, in the Southeast District, down in 15th Avenue with my wife, Donna.
Mike, you are on the city council right now, correct?
I am.
But you're the newest member, because as I recall, last year there was a vacancy. You and a number of other citizens just applied, and you got on the board. So you're one of the few councilmen who hasn't been elected. You were just picked by the council, right?
I was appointed.
Why did you apply for that vacancy on the city council last year?
Well, you know, I've spent many years of my career working for different government agencies, started in the Army, then I started on the police department here in Aberdeen. I was a county sheriff, and then I went back to work for the city of Aberdeen as a code enforcement officer and retired in 2014. So my interest in government and just, you know, I'm happy with what Aberdeen has done for me in my career. And this is just a way to give back to my community, I think, to try to represent my neighborhood in a fair and responsible way.
Sure. Now, you mentioned code enforcement, your work as a code enforcement officer in town. What did you learn in that work that has maybe informed your work now as a city councilman?
Well, I think it any level, whatever your position is in city government or county government, you get an idea of the different department functions that you work with and rely on in carrying out your particular duties. And so you get a good understanding of how that government works, budgeting, working with other departments and so forth.
Sure. What, as a code enforcement officer before on city council, what did you actually do in that position?
We were responsible for property maintenance issues. We would get calls. A lot of it was reactive type enforcement. People would call in and complain about a neighbor or about a building or about a yard that was unkept or a deteriorating building, and we would respond and notify the owners, try to resolve that situation. It became more proactive where we were actually going out and looking for issues to try and resolve for the community.
Sure. And so, I mean, now that you're on city commission, you know, certainly there are still code issues going on. What's the general state of Aberdeen in terms of code compliance and code enforcement? Do you see any major problems in that area around town?
I see a few every now and then, but you know, the program started in 2003, and I think the community is much more aware of property maintenance issues and that there is actually someone enforcing that for them, and so the compliance rate is much higher than when we started in 2003. For what it is today, it's much higher.
Now, code compliance, for some people, that's regulation. You're telling me what to do with my yard. You're telling me what to do with my garage. How do you see code, you know, building code, yard code, whatever, how does that make Aberdeen a better place, all this regulation?
Well, you know, when new families move to town, they're looking for a quiet, safe neighborhood, one that has good property values. And the way you protect them is to clean up properties. So that, you know, it's an attractive place for people to live. And so I think that's the biggest thing, is that it encourages new families to move into different neighborhoods.
Just as a side note, and then we kind of want to talk more about your vision for the city, but where can people get find information about codes and how do they know how to be compliant, and How do they make sure they're on the right side of the law?
They would go to Aberdeen City's website, go to Planning and Zoning, and that's where code enforcement comes out of. And it's a nice website. It states all the requirements, has some pictures of different violations so people understand what they can or can't do. You know, going on or investigating people's personal property is kind of sensitive, and a lot of people take issue with that. They feel that, you know, if it's on my property, I can do pretty much anything I want, and that's not always the case. You have a responsibility to your neighbors and the neighborhood and the city.
So moving from, you know, city code enforcement officer now to councilman, you see a different side of government from that position. Over the year that you've been on the council, what's been the hardest part of this job?
Well, I haven't found it all that difficult because, you know, we have an excellent city manager who oversees all of the departments. And so we don't see a lot of conflict within departments because our department heads are doing a very good job. The biggest thing I noticed when I got on the council is the tax dollars that go through city government. I was used to, you know, Edmonds County, relatively small, not that big of a budget, but Aberdeen has a huge budget, a lot of tax dollars that needs to be spread out responsibly and efficiently so that, you know, we try to protect taxes from being increased or anything like that.
Sure. Now, you've been on for a year. You're filling a vacancy. So your particular race is to complete the term for another 3 years, correct?
That's correct, yes.
So looking at these 3 years, if you get to go back, what are your priorities for the next 3 years on the city council? What do you want to achieve, and what do you want Aberdeen to achieve?
Well, right now there's a concern about water issues in the community around Aberdeen, and I want to protect the resources we currently have and try to look into the future, because at some point, if Aberdeen keeps growing as it has, we're going to need more water, a bigger supply, and right now the city is actually exploring new wells that could supplement our supply. And so that's going to be one of my main priorities. We currently have an industry that wants to come to Aberdeen, but they're going to demand a lot of water. And as we continue to develop residential areas, that increases our demand. So we need to take a real close look at that. That's going to be one of my main concerns.
Sure, and we've heard a lot about water. I mean, the paper's been covering it this week, good two-part series. We know AGP, the soybean plant, they're going to use a large amount of water. Now, we can handle AGP's water demand, correct?
Certainly.
Do you have any idea, and I hope this isn't too technical, but how many more, like, AGPs or big industries could Aberdeen handle with its current water situation?
Well, it would depend upon what their demand is. You know, right now, we're at our peak demand. We're using about 6 million gallons a day. Our treatment plant can handle about 11 million a day. So we're at a pretty good level right now. When AGP gets going, you know, that daily use is probably going to be between 7 and 8 million a day.
AGP adds that much, 1 to 2 million gallons a day, we're thinking.
Well, that's with the beef plant as well.
Right, right.
We anticipate they're going to increase a little bit too.
Okay. Even from their current production, they've got room to increase.
They want to keep increasing. So that's going to, you know, increase that demand.
Right. And so it sounds like, I mean, when you mentioned the water treatment plant that's up north of town here,
yes,
they can handle 11 million gallons a day. So even beyond, if we have to drill more wells in the future or find other sources, it's also a matter of infrastructure. We'd have to build more capacity at the water plant, right?
That, or around town, maybe another water tower, you know, strategically located to help a particular area of the city. So, yes, we want to increase our daily supply as well.
Sure. Are there any further conservation measures the city could do to stretch its water supply to support, you know, new development? I know right now we've got watering restrictions just in general. Don't water during the daytime, 11 to 5. Is there anything else the city could do to use its water more efficiently?
Well, you know, there's been some talk of the city supplying some water outside of the city limits to help with this web moratorium that's going on. That's possible, you know. Right now, we probably couldn't do a lot, but that's why we're looking to the future. We want to be able to help in those areas if we can.
That's kind of an interesting reversal because several years ago, it was Aberdeen was thinking about hooking up to Webb. Now, you're talking about maybe Webb or Webb customers hooking up to Aberdeen.
That's right. it's quite a turnaround. And, you know, even if we would help in some area, to take the load off of Webb, there's no guarantee that they would give that water to someone close to Aberdeen. They cover a huge area. So even if we would try to do that, there's no guarantee that we would be helping someone close to Aberdeen.
Sure. And as Aberdeen City Council, that is your first view. You want to make sure that your decisions and the use of, well, our water and other resources are benefiting this community first.
Absolutely, yes.
What would the cost be for to drill an additional well?
Well, that hasn't been brought to us. I'm sure someone older on the council may have some information on that. That has happened in the past. Current pricing, I really don't have any idea what that would be at the time.
Sure. Well, now, having water is about the most basic thing we can do to make sure people and businesses can come to Aberdeen. What else can the city council do? And what else do you want to do on council to draw more residents, more workers, more businesses to Aberdeen to keep the city growing?
Well, you know, infrastructure is always a primary concern. Streets are always a concern of the public. We need to keep improving those, replacing some of our infrastructure that has gotten old over the years. You know, Aberdeen's been around for a while, and some of that infrastructure needs replacement. And that helps enhance new neighborhoods, getting water and sewer to those locations in a reliable way so that we can continue to grow. And so that's another big concern of mine, that we continue to upgrade our current infrastructure.
And Tell us, turning culturally.
Well, I guess it's infrastructure and it's culture. We have a library switch coming up. The new building is getting built. We're going to move some books over this year, right?
Yes.
Awesome. Can't wait to walk there. Tell us your thoughts about the new library building, whether it was a good idea for Aberdeen, and about the old library building, what you think we ought to do with that structure once we make the move.
Well, on your second point, that's kind of a hot issue right now, selling this old library. I believe the offer that was made by the chamber was an interesting, and to me, I thought it was a good idea, a great location for them. However, my personal views aren't necessarily what I'm there to represent. I'm there to represent a bigger majority of people, and so I have to take that into account. And so right now we're waiting on the appraisal, and that's going to determine a lot how we make that sale. The new library, it's a wonderful facility. I really wasn't on the council when that decision was made. I was aware, though, of the investment the city made in the old library before they decided to build a new one. And so I really wanted to see more of the cost issue. What would it have cost to fix up the old library, to keep it going, versus what our new library cost us? I would have liked to weigh that a little closer, and I never did see those numbers, really. And so that would have been an interest of mine during that decision-making process.
Okay. Now, how long have you lived in Aberdeen, if I may ask?
Well, I grew up in Ipswich on a farm. Mm-hmm. Out by Ipswich, but I started my career here in 1974. I worked for 5 years on the police department, then I was a Edmonds County Sheriff for 16, then I came back to Aberdeen in the mid-90s to late 90s, and have been in Aberdeen ever since.
Sure. So, I mean, and even in Ipswich, you grew up anywhere around here, you know what's going on in Aberdeen.
Absolutely.
Too. You're part of the show. So, over that time, you've seen a lot of changes in Aberdeen. You've seen people go, people come. How do you think Aberdeen is doing at welcoming newcomers in town?
Well, I think we're doing a great job. You know, they refer to Aberdeen as a hub city. We are the hub for Northeast South Dakota, and we rely on a lot of these smaller communities that surround Aberdeen. We need to pay particular interest to our retail industry here in Aberdeen, because that's what attracts people, that's what keeps us going, and so we want to be friendly to our neighbors out there in the agriculture community and to these smaller communities.
Sure. All right, Mike Olson, if voters want to get a hold of you before the election, which is June 6th, everybody, that's just less than 2 weeks away now, if voters want to talk to you, what's the best way for them to do that, Mike?
Actually, my phone number and my email is on the Aberdeen website, City of Aberdeen website. You can go there.
That's aberdeen.sd.us.
Yes.
Just look for City Council.
Yep.
Okay.
And all the council members are there. Our phone numbers and our emails are there. They can sure do it that way.
Any email or phone, you'll pick up and get back to them, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Mike Olson, candidate for Southeast District for the 3-year term. Thank you for visiting with Dakota Free Press today.
I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, good conversation. Always glad to visit with candidates. And again, we mentioned it there, we'll repeat. Aberdeen's city election and school board election is coming up in less than a couple weeks,
right?
On June 6th. So you can vote early at the courthouse. Mm-hmm. Anytime, just drop in, fill out a ballot, or be ready to go on June 6th. Get out and vote for your city council people and for your school board members.
All right. Other than that, looks like the Brown County Dems are meeting Thursday, May 25th at the Eagles.
Yeah, if you're listening to this podcast hot off the press, Brown County Democrats Thursday evening. This is our regular monthly meeting. We'll talk about some summer events and anything else that comes to mind.
Okay, and then we've got the SDDP, South Dakota Democratic Party.
Yes, for you statewide listeners around the state, the state Democrats are having, it's an interesting event. I don't know if they've done this before. They call it an issues caucus.
Okay.
And on June 9th and 10th on the Augustana campus, and you can get more details at the Democratic Party website, sddp.org. It's all there. But June 9th and 10th, they're going to host basically a series of panel discussions on different issues. I think they're talking about Native American issues, LGBT issues, other issues that are going to come up, you know, in the state platform, and issues that may come up in the campaign next year. Good opportunity to meet some decision makers, talk about issues, maybe even talk about becoming a decision maker. June 9th and 10th, a couple weeks from now, down in Sioux Falls.
Okay, the Progressive Happy Hour is taking a break for the summer.
Everybody goes to the lake in the summer.
So go put your toes in the water, maybe barbecue some brats, have a couple of beers, relax in the sand, maybe catch a fish or two. What are you going to do? It'll
and,
be fine.
And take our podcast with you, because we are there great listening out at the lake.
And then in the fall, we'll get together. We'll talk about President Pence and how he's doing. And I'm just kidding.
And how we'll beat him in 2018.
Right, right. Okay, if you got a couple of bucks, once again, please throw them in the tip jar.
We like to go to the lake too, but we'll spend your money on our server.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can find the tip jar right on the side of the page, and it's also in the comment section. Having said that, hey man, thanks for tuning in. Please keep listening. We appreciate any comments you want to send us, any questions that you have for us. If you want to record us a new theme song, we would also like to hear that. And with that, Corey, I think we got another one in the can.
You bet. Send those suggestions and theme songs to Corey@DakotaFreePress.com. And as Spencer said, thank you so much for tuning in. Glad to have you on Dakota Free Press.